we'll get started for the second round of the sessions today. I hope you've been adequately refueled and recharged for this new panel. And since most of the first panelists are here, I'll just say that this time we have a rather young panel. I'm including myself in that, so so I think we'll get a little change, perhaps. They promised me it's going to be a high-charged one. So we're going to be moving on to look at Taiwan's strategic capability vis-a-vis China, strengths and weaknesses. Of course, there's a lot of discussion that we've already had on this, but these three gentlemen also have been have actually produced several reports and a book on these topics. So I think we'll get their take on these things rather systematically as we move forward. And I want to just, what I'll do is I'll just introduce each of them and then all together, and then let them take it one by one. And also, in case you're following the program, I just want to make a quick correction. We have we must have had some kind of a printing error over here that we just realized. Maybe the printer played a April Fool's joke on us, but the topics assigned to the individuals are not actually the ones that they're going to talk about. They're going to talk about, I'm not going to force them to talk about the topics that they that their name appears over, because we will start first with David Gitter. I think the two Davids threw everything off here. Okay, it's your fault, Davids. But we start with David Gitter on Taiwan's strong but stifled foundations of national power. We will then go on to David Ahn, who will talk about reconstructing Taiwan's military strategy, achieving forward defense through multi-domain deterrence. And we will end it all with Ian Easton, who will be talking about the Chinese invasion threat, Taiwan's defense, and American strategy in Asia. That's the title of his book, and I don't think he wants to let anybody else talk about that. I don't think David Gitter wants to talk about that. Okay, so apologies on that little snafu over here. Let me just say just a couple of things about each one of them. David Gitter is the director of the Party Watch Initiative. He has also worked previously in the Congressional Research Service, as well as the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He is an alum of the Elliott School, so welcome home, David. David Ahn is at the Global Taiwan Institute, and before that, he was a political military affairs officer at the U.S. State Department from 2009 to 2014, and he actually started the first Taiwan interagency political military visits to the U.S., which I think was mentioned in the last panel. So he has been very contributed a lot in terms of the actual policy making. And finally, Ian Easton is at the Project 2049 Institute. And he has worked previously at the Center for Naval Analysis, and he lived in Taipei from 2005 to 2010, and he has actually just returned from Taiwan, where I think he was promoting the book, I presume. So all of these gentlemen have actually hands-on experience as well as a strong analytical research skills, and so we really look forward to rounding out the conference with them. So, to begin with, we will start with David Gitter. Thank you very much, and please join me in welcoming them.
Okay, well, good evening, everybody. It's great to be back at the Elliott School, and of course to be on this panel with two great friends of mine as well. So as you know, I'm going to be talking about my special report which I did for NBR a few years ago. The topic is Taiwan's strong but stifled foundations of national power. And I think the title goes a long way in describing how Dr. Sutter and I view the topic. Dr. Sutter was my co-author for this paper, so I'll do my best to represent his decades of experience on the topic. I know many of you are his students here today. And as I was saying, the report is part of a series. So our first report delved into the resources available to Taiwan. The second report was authored by Dr. Stephen Goldstein of Harvard University, and that really discussed Taiwan's strategic culture and the inputs of it, largely that it is its sense of international isolation which helps decide that strategic culture. I definitely recommend it. And the third, of course, is David Ahn's, which assesses the drivers of Taiwan's military strategy. So without further ado, I want to dig into my topic here. To sum up, you could say that Taiwan is an innovative society. It has always been since its formation. And the same spirit that helped transform Taiwan from an underdeveloped agricultural economy into a world-class exporter of high-tech goods, that's all still true today. Taiwan remains an exporter of high-tech goods. It has a lot of assets when compared to China across the strait. These include Taiwan's legal system, which has true rule of law and has the ability to protect the interests of its citizens and also foreigners and foreign businesses operating there. It has an ideal location. It straddles both the South China Sea and the East China Sea and all of the very important trade routes that pass through that area, trillions of dollars of trade a year. And I think it's also worth pointing out that Taiwan has a very large economy. In fact, it is the 23rd largest in the world. And so while it is dwarfed by the size of China's economy, it is by no means a small one. In fact, there are 46 firms on the Forbes Global 2000 list from Taiwan. Now, one of the dangers here, even despite the fact that Taiwan produces all these high-tech goods, is that a lot of its production has shifted across the strait to China. And skeptics worry that this could enable the slow transfer of technology and know-how that will eventually allow China to outcompete its Taiwanese counterparts. And in the long term, this would really diminish Taiwan's capability to defend itself, because less resources means less resources to input to defense. Another point worth mentioning are that Taiwanese business people operating in China, the Taishang, are viewed as one of the most vulnerable segments of Taiwanese society. China naturally views them as the most invested in good cross-strait relations, and for Beijing, that means Taiwan concessions on its political status. Taiwan's population is 23.5 million strong. Just to give you an idea, that's about the size of Shanghai, not quite. However, it is a very highly educated and skilled workforce. But the important thing to realize here is that the workforce is set to shrink. In fact, Taiwan's population on the whole is set to shrink by the mid-2020s. And you know, this obviously is not a good thing for Taiwan, not only for Taiwan's economy, but fewer pieces, fewer people means fewer soldiers. It means fewer people who can defend the island. Now, in principle, this has been an area of an agreement between the KMT and DPP, and there's really only one answer, that being immigration. They've talked about trying to make the island a place for happy marriages in order to increase birth rates, but that's not realistic. Immigration is the only answer. And we've actually seen advancement in this area as well. For example, the new southbound policy aims to make visa regulations and rules for ASEAN countries a lot easier. It also includes scholarship opportunities for people to come and work and study on the island. More recently, there have been advances in internship visas, special work visas, and in special cases, even the opportunity for dual citizenship for foreigners who are deemed to be high-level professionals that would not have to give up their former passport. So I think all this is I think this is all very good for Taiwan. Most recently, in this past February, the Taiwan Act for Recruitment and Employment of Foreign Professional Talent was put into effect. So this was a bipartisan effort that is now in force in Taiwan, and this focuses on promoting artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, semiconductors, green energy, and other technologies of the future. And this also complements other policies by the current government, such as the 5+2 Industrial Innovation Plan, which also seeks to put aside funds in order to develop these very important sectors of the economy. So in the near term, the hope is that this can help offset the very severe brain drain that Taiwan has been experiencing. And of course, it's worth noting that one of the prime places that Taiwanese choose to go is right across the strait to China. So in the near term, if this can offset that brain drain, I think that's great. In the long term, I think it's important to point out that these people, if more foreigners come and start families on Taiwan, and if they, presumably a generation later, you're going to have a cohort of Taiwanese citizens who are bilingual and bicultural and can really help Taiwan further integrate into the region, which is, of course, what Taiwan is trying to do. So all of this seems promising, but we also have to remember that Taiwan is competing with other nations in the region. And I'll point out the obvious one being China. China has a number of programs that throws a lot of money to attract foreigners and what they call overseas Chinese. There is the Thousand Talents Program. They have investment funds specifically designated to attract overseas Chinese. And most recently, we have something called the 31 New Incentives. Now, this plan is specifically meant to attract Taiwanese to China. And the rubric that they're using is that, they try to talk about Taiwanese operating in China as equals. But what this is really aimed to do is to worsen Taiwan's brain drain and really to increase dependency on China. So I think this is something that Taiwan will have to counter in the near term. In the long term, Taiwan can offer all sorts of grants and study opportunities, but people are going to go where the jobs are and where the higher paying jobs are. And so I think that's still where Taiwan has to place the most emphasis. I'm going to talk a little bit about Taiwan's island geography, which I'm sure you all know a lot about. I think you can sum it up as both a blessing and a curse, and that's how we describe it in our report. Taiwan's island is a blessing because of the military defense capabilities that it offers the island. I'm sure the other two speakers are going to go into this in more depth, but essentially the Taiwan Strait is a giant moat, and that prevents vast superior forces from overrunning the island, which probably would have happened a long time ago if that weren't the case. As Ian's book makes very clear, it's not at all evident that China has the capability currently to carry out such a military adventure. However, when it comes to trade, Taiwan is extremely vulnerable, and that is, they're vulnerable not only to natural disasters and other forms of disruption, but they're extremely vulnerable to being cut off by China. And that is one of the first things that China will probably do in any sort of conflict. And this is particularly true when it comes to energy. So this came up on the first panel a bit, but Taiwan currently remains dependent on imports of oil, natural gas, as well as coal. And these imports pass through regions such as the South China Sea, which China increasingly asserts its control over. So from an outside perspective, at least I can speak for myself and Dr. Sutter, it seems unfortunate that Taiwan has decided to turn its back on nuclear energy. The current plan for Taiwan's energy policy is to, by I think 2025, completely eliminate nuclear energy. It plans instead to raise the importance of renewables to around 20% was the figure I saw, but also to raise very expensive imports of natural gas to 50%. In short, you could say that Taiwan's environmental concerns have trumped its energy security concerns, including the threat of blockade. When it comes to trade, we know that Taiwan is still reliant on its main adversary. If you look at 2016 data, you'll see that Taiwan's trade is around 30%. 30% is with China, which is more than double that of ASEAN. And unfortunately, Taiwan also remains stifled when it comes to finding other trade partners to have different free trade agreements with. And that's of course because China objects to that and puts pressure on other nations to not engage in that way with Taiwan. But I did want to talk about one example which I think has a silver lining for Taiwan, which is tourism. And we see that currently tourism again is rising from China to Taiwan. It after the DPP came to power, it did drop significantly, and that was because of Chinese restrictions and Chinese discouragement to travel to Taiwan. But it's up again, and the question is why? And I think the answer is that it was counterproductive, or at least it didn't produce the results that China was hoping for. And one of the most interesting things is that during that same period, South Korean tourists almost completely made up for the Chinese tourists to Taiwan. And of course, the question is, why did that happen, especially at that time? And I think this has a lot to do with the bilateral dispute that was going on between China and South Korea about that same time. And I'm talking about the placement of the THAAD missile defense system in South Korea. So during that period, China utilized all sorts of economic coercion against South Korea. There was a ban on South Korean culture and pop stars coming to China. And it just wasn't a very friendly environment for South Koreans at that time. And so naturally, they were looking for another place to go to. And it seems they chose Taiwan. So I think this is a good case study where you have two societies. Both were experiencing economic coercion from China, and both were able to essentially collaborate and enjoy the benefits of each other. And this is something that I'm going to come back to in a few minutes. I think I'm running short on time here, but I'm going to briefly talk about Taiwan's situation on the international stage. We see that Taiwan utilizes a system of unofficial relationships, both bilateral and multilateral, in order to meet its needs. And on the whole, Taiwan has been extremely effective in doing this. It participates at various levels. Sometimes it's called a member, other times it's called an observer. But in the end, it is able to secure Taiwan's critical needs. You know, there are rising concerns, and there have always been concerns that China also uses coercion here to try to force different organizations not to invite Taiwan or to force Taiwan to participate internationally under labels that do not accurately describe Taiwan society, such as Taiwan China and other such labels. And this appears almost certain to continue, and we're seeing that happen right now at the World Health Organization. But this is going to continue into the future, and there's really no reason to believe that this is going to stop. And this also relates to Taiwan's list of diplomatic allies. We can also expect China, that is, to continue to put pressure on countries to switch relations to China. And I would say, you know, one of the things that the Party Watch Initiative looks a lot at is the CCP International Department. And not many people pay attention to them, but they also play a role in meeting with countries and pushing the One China policy. I would expect for the International Department to play an increasing role in this effort. And if you look at their past visits, they do meet with political parties from countries that recognize Taiwan. And I think that's something that Taiwan should pay more attention to. So I want to wrap up with just a few observations before turning it over to David, I believe, is next. As I mentioned with the tourism example, case study, Taiwan is not the only victim of Chinese coercion. And in recent years, we've seen Chinese coercion against Japan, South Korea, India, and others. I think that Taiwan should be paying very careful attention to those disputes, because even if out of tactical advantage, if one of these countries are seeking tactical advantage in their dispute with China, I still think that's an opportunity for Taiwan, because even short-term or tactical relations, exchanges with Taiwan now could eventually bloom into something much more fruitful in the future. So that's one observation. The second observation is that I think we really have to take into account what's going on in China currently, and I'm talking about politics. We see that General Secretary Xi Jinping has pretty completely consolidated his power over China. And you know, that's true not only for the party, but also for the military and everything else. And we also see that Xi Jinping likes to put his name in as many things as possible. So in other words, Xi Jinping is really attempting to not only advance his authority, but to claim credit for things that go his way. And I think this is important because we can expect Xi Jinping to be in power for a very long time. It's my opinion that Xi Jinping really would like to see during his reign, which could be for, we're looking maybe a decade or more into the future, I think he wants to see progress on Taiwan. And I think we know this because he emphasizes the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, which inevitably means that that Taiwan needs to be absorbed. In fact, the great rejuvenation cannot happen until the motherland is reunified. So if you look at Xi Jinping's personality, you see that he likes to be a strong leader. I don't think he trusts others a lot, so I think he's the only one who thinks he can get it done. And I would expect to see more pressure on Taiwan from China for many years to come. And the final observation I wanted to make was that even though, as you heard from my presentation, Taiwan has limited resources and probably could not compete head-on with China for extended periods of time over large areas, but if you read Ian's book, you'll realize that Taiwan doesn't have to. Taiwan has to devote the limited resources that it has to very specific moments in time and spaces and areas on the ground, meaning, I think, invasion beaches. So if Taiwan is able to assess its security situation, if it's able to see when hostilities are going to begin, then I think it stands a good chance at mustering all of its resources to devote towards that effort. And so those are my comments, and I hope you found them useful. Thank you.
I think you've kicked us off on a really good note here, laying out the sort of economic, political, and military profile vis-a-vis China that Taiwan has. And now, since later on, we'll go focus a little bit more on just on the military aspect. So, David.
All right,
I think
thank
he's
you.
Walk around. So.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Deepa allowed me to move away from the lectern. So glad to be here, and I want to thank GW Seeker Center for inviting me. And since the organizers asked me to speak about the NBR paper, National Bureau of Asian Research paper, I wrote, also thank NBR as well. So what I'm looking at today is the question of how do we explain Taiwan's current military strategy, and how can that strategy change over time? And when NBR asked me to write about this about a year ago, even though it was just published a month ago, NBR asked me to follow on David Gitter and Professor Bob Sutter's co-authored publication on Taiwan's military capabilities. But it's three parts of a series, so I was the third of three. And the other one, as David said, was Professor Stephen Goldstein, currently at Harvard, Fairbanks Center. So his paper was titled, Taiwan, Asia's Orphan? And he examines the issue of Taiwan's identity and the issue of abandonment. So when the NBR organizers asked me to write, they said, just like in academia, look at what has already been written in this series and then build on top of that. look at the important work that they've already done, then how do you take the identity piece, the isolation, abandonment piece that Goldstein wrote about, plus Sutter Gitter's Taiwan military capabilities, to then explain Taiwan's current military strategy? So when Dr. Ashley Tellis worked with me on this in the early phases, kind of advised me and we discussed different concepts, he recommended taking what's called a quote-unquote rational reconstruction of Taiwan's military strategies. Because if you take a historical analysis of exactly how it formed, then there could be a million factors. It could be bureaucratic politics and tug-of-war, push and pull between different bureaus. It could be organizational process, standard operating procedures. It could be the personalities of leaders, political parties. There's so many different, almost infinite number of factors. However, if I were to take a rational reconstruction, which I did in this paper, then I boiled it down to as few as possible that had explanatory power. And those were three. The first two are very obvious. The first is the level of threat that China poses toward Taiwan. And the second is the level of support that the U.S. is putting into Taiwan, especially security and defense support. And number three is the one that's not as obvious, is Taiwan's domestic perception of that threat from China and that support from the U.S. So with the variation of these three factors, I argue see the current formation of Taiwan's military strategy, as well as if that strategy will become more assertive, more aggressive, or more passive, or complacent in the future. So to start with number one, Taiwan's military strategy depends on the threat from China. If the threat from China were to diminish, then we could expect that the military strategy would not have to be as capable as it currently is. But what we've been seeing, when we look at the empirics over recent years, not to mention that the past 20, 30 years of China's military modernization, is that in recent years, we're seeing more fighter aircraft flights from China, the PLA Air Force, encircling Taiwan. You're seeing new bomber flights that you haven't seen beyond 1 or 2 years ago. You're seeing this new aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, making more transits through the Taiwan Strait. So you're seeing also not only the raw capabilities, but you're also seeing the intentions that Taiwan, that China has for Taiwan. Intentions toward unification and intentions of not disavowing the use of force toward Taiwan. So if we combine the capabilities and intentions, you can see really that the threat picture of China toward Taiwan is actually increasing, especially with recent events. But if you look at the U.S. support for Taiwan, recently you're seeing the Taiwan Travel Act with senior officials from the U.S. going to Taipei. You're seeing the National Defense Authorization Act of 2018, where Congress is telling the executive branch,